Welcome to this event at the Hay Festival. I'm just going to run a check that the people at the back can hear me. So if you're in the back row and you can hear me, could you put your arms up? Good. I'm worried about those people who are in the back row who didn't put their arms up, because if you can't hear me now, it means that you will hear nothing for the rest of the evening. This session is entitled Between Communism and Capitalism, Illusions of a Happy World. And just before the session started, I asked one of the organizers who had thought of this title. And she told me, "We thought you did." And I said, "No, I thought you did." I've asked Gary. He doesn't know who thought of it. We have a feeling, therefore, that you imagined it collectively, that it is actually a kind of, it's your fault that this is what we're discussing, because it's you turned up for this when we didn't even know what it meant. Yeah. So I think it's a kind of good and surreal way to start the evening. You also will notice that, unfortunately, Ingo Schulze is not with us physically. I assure you, he is here with us spiritually, and we will be trying to imagine how he might respond to some of our discussion. I'm David Aronovich. I'm a Times columnist, a columnist on the Times of London, that is, not of the New York Times, and author of a book about conspiracy theories. I'm very much not the main act this evening. The main act is on my right, who is Gary Steingart. Gary Steingart is one of, what, according to The New Yorker, he's one of the 20 best authors under 40. Wasn't the 40 best authors under 20, which would have been even more impressive.
In 2 years, I will no longer be under 40, so,
I'm just
enjoying it while I can.
Yeah, that's right. He'll be then one of the greatest 50 authors over 50, or whatever it becomes, fairly soon, 10 years later. Anyway, that's what he is. His most famous book in Britain is Absurdistan, but he also has a new book out, which was described in the New York Times by the very difficult critic, Michiko Kakutani, whose word people listen for with great trepidation, as super sad, super funny, super affecting, and the book is called Super Sad True Love Story. Now, Gary will be talking about that book tomorrow with Peter Franz, so we're not specifically discussing that book this evening. What we're going to be talking a bit about, I think, is about whether there is a place that we can find where people can be happy. A system that we can imagine where people can be happy, and how systems up until now have disappointed us. The key element to Gary's biography is that he was actually born in Leningrad, not St. Petersburg, in Leningrad in 1972. And his family went over, they were Russian Jews, went over to New York in 1979. So he transitioned from one system to a completely different system. And therefore, in a sense, carries with him both a sense of achievement and maybe a sense of loss too. Now, I'm going to just make a brief description of my own background, much less interesting. But I made a similar transition because my parents were both members of the British Communist Party. In fact, my father worked for the British Communist Party. So I too was brought up under communism. It's just the communism I was brought up under ended at our front door. And when we opened the door and went out, we went out into capitalism. So in a way, we transitioned every day in a kind of different way. So I think, Gary, one of the things that I think would be interesting is just to go back and imagine or to think about, I know it's difficult with a seven-year-old, what it was that you noticed was actually different about the system in the place you arrived from the system that you left?
Yes. Well, as you said, I arrived in the United States in 1979. It was the last year of the Carter administration. And we left, and it was still Brezhnev in the Soviet Union. I remember landing at JFK Airport and thinking it was science fiction, just the size of the terminal. And I saw my first person smiling. In Russia, you never smile. But I saw a person at the desk smiling. And I tried to smile back, but I didn't have the right muscles for it. So I kind of made this face, you know. And I remember the first cars we saw, and also, you know, people of different races. There were a few African exchange students in Russia, but not really that many. So it was really, you know, I have relatives now who moved from Russia to America, and it's an adjustment. But back then, it was like moving from a different planet to another planet.
How do you remember your parents talking about the differences? I mean, the reasons why they'd wanted to move and whether they felt satisfied with the results of that move?
Well, my father wanted to move because he really felt a sense of Jewish identity. My mother just wanted a better economic life for us. So their reasons were very different. And I think, you know, they got very lucky. My parents were like all Soviet parents. My father was a mechanical engineer, and my mother was a pianist. I think that's the standard. And when they came, you know, a lot of people had to work as taxi drivers, or my father found a job very quickly. So they fell in love with American capitalism in a way that was just completely open. It was just, they loved it so much, and they hated communism so much. And I go back to Russia every year, but my parents have never been back in 31 years. And this is, next year I'm taking them with me, but they never go.
Are you taking them with you forcibly, or are they agreeing to it?
I'm paying them per hour to travel with me.
When they were describing what they had left, not just what they saw, but when they described the system they had left to you, because you were a child, what do you remember about their description of it, the way in which they talked about it?
Well, I remember my early years in Russia very well. I left as a child, but I remember being completely in love with Lenin. I lived in Leningrad, and there was a huge statue of Lenin, the biggest statue of Lenin in Leningrad, so you can imagine how big that is. And he was, we called him the Latin Lenin, because he was very dashing and handsome. He was holding out his hat like this, and they called him the Latin Lenin. Every morning I would get up and I would hug the statue, the pedestal, because I thought he was so beautiful. And my grandmother, who was a journalist, asked me to write a novel about Lenin when I was 5 years old. And she paid me in little pieces of cheese for each page that I wrote. And I wrote my first novel when I was about five, and it was about Lenin meeting a magical goose and trying to conquer Finland and make a socialist country out of Finland. And in the end, there was a political argument, and Lenin eats the goose, which is very sad. But that was and I really wanted to join the Komsomol, the Youth League, and the Red Pioneers, and all of this stuff. I really, when you're a child, it's very easy to admire something as strong and powerful a system as Soviet communism. But my parents, when we came to America, a couple of months later, they said to me, you have to stop loving Lenin, and you have to start loving Reagan, because he had just won the election. So I said, okay, you know, I can do it. And we became very Republican and the whole thing.
So as you grew up, did that attachment to Lenin, which was a kind of obviously child's emotional one, did it begin to transfer itself into a desire to in some way defend the Soviet Union or the memory of the Soviet Union or what was special about the Soviet Union?
It was very hard for me because in 1980, being Russian in America was very, very difficult. I went to a Hebrew school, and the children would hate me just because I was from Russia. So even in Hebrew school, I had to pretend that, like Ingo Schultz, I was born in Berlin. It was better to be German in the Hebrew school than Russian.
Ingo says he was born in Dresden. Born in Dresden. So he was born in the old German Democratic Republic.
Right.
He would like to remind you.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Ingo. He looks better this way than I remember. I met him once, yeah. What was the question? Sorry.
We were interrupted by Ingo, I'm afraid, but...
he's so noisy, even when he's absent.
It can't be helped. It was really about whether you found yourself defending the Soviet Union as a kind of emotional response to your own childhood, because you must have heard a lot of people saying it was absolutely terrible, it was dreadful, and of course your parents said the same thing. Coming from them, it may have been one thing. Coming from somebody else, it may have felt like an accusation against your childhood.
Well, you know, when you're a child and you're an immigrant, the idea is to try to assimilate as quickly as possible. So being Russian was the worst thing you can be, so I tried to be the opposite, the most American ever, since John Wayne, you know. I used to watch the show Dallas as a child, and so I saved up money to build an office just like the hero of Dallas, J.R. Ewing. And I bought the hat, the cowboy hat.
Is that true?
It's all true. I'm very sad about it, but it's all true, yeah. So, you know, I tried to make up for a feeling of being very Russian by doing the opposite. I remember when I came, I had the big shapka, the big Russian hat, and a big coat made out of a moose or an elk or something. And I remember the teacher would come up and just take off my hat and say, "We can't wear this in this country," you know. So that's why I got the cowboy hat. Yeah. It was a very difficult assimilation, again, also because I think, you know, as I said, I have young relatives who come. And now the world is so much more global, you know, if you come from any part of the world, you know what the dominant culture, you know about Lady Gaga and all this stuff. But when we came from the Soviet Union, we knew nothing. You know, I had to learn about ABBA, you know, the hard way. It was...
What is the easy way to learn about ABBA?
There is no easy way. You know, and it was only until I went to college. I went to a small Marxist college in the state of Ohio called Oberlin. And there, being Russian was considered a very privileged position because everybody was communist. So all of a sudden, I started, you know, I got my accent back and became more Russian. It's a fluid identity, you know.
That's quite interesting. When you say this is a Marxist college, you don't mean that it was founded by Marxists. You mean that there was an ethos there amongst some of the students that was fairly left-wing?
Students and faculty.
Students and faculty. That must have seemed curious to you, or did you choose it for that reason?
Well, I chose it because I was in love with this woman and she went there. And
she chose it.
She broke up with me the first day, you know. She said, I want to date a rich Marxist, not a poor one.
That joke obviously goes down very well in Spanish. it crosses the borders and so on. But even so, what I'm getting at is that here you are, you come from Russia, you're told that things Russian are bad, your parents want to get away, communism is bad. You adopt the American system, you become Republicans. This is, if you like, your adopted state. And now you find yourself, for whatever reason, at this college where people are saying, no, you know, actually, where you came from wasn't so bad. We're the bad ones. I mean, as you know, no one can knock America like American intellectuals can knock America. I mean, absolutely no one. That must have seemed strange Did you orientate yourself against them or towards them?
Well, I became one of them because, it was very hard to... It's very hard to be different in a small community in the middle of Ohio. Whether you're a Mormon or a Russian or whatever you are, you go with the flow. I was in the Department of Political Science, and they asked me to write a thesis about how the Soviet Union should get back together and destroy America once and for all. This was 1995, and my thesis was called Back in the USSR. And interestingly enough, in 1960 in Leningrad, my father had written almost the same thesis.
So was this a serious thing that they asked you to do? Or was it a kind of early understanding of your role as a satirist?
Well, yes. I mean, it was 1990s, early 90s, and the Soviet Union had just collapsed. And the faculty was very depressed about this, They had these little, everything they had was in little red. I remember seeing an espresso cup with a red star. They had red Volvos, and it was called the People's Volvo, which was very nice. So they were very upset by the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in me, a young Russian in America, they thought they saw somebody who could write about this and try to renew the faith.
What was their critique of the country that they themselves lived in and that in many ways they benefited from?
Well, the critique of America, which is a lot more understandable now after the economic system has begun to decline in America, is the sense of a lack of fairness. It used to be in America that a person without even a high school degree could get a job as a worker and could advance themselves and could live a middle-class lifestyle without even having a high school degree. But now, over the course of the last 20, 30 years since Reagan on, that split between rich and poor has grown exponentially. And now there are people who have college degrees who can't get a decent job in America or even graduate degrees. So that was, I think, their chief concern was this huge gap, the growing disparity in America.
In real terms, what's happened is a gap not between the rich and the poor, but between the very richest and everyone else. Actually, the disparities lower down haven't really grown much at all, which is a sort of unique system. It almost takes you back, doesn't it, to the situation in which you would have aristocrats. Of course, though, aristocrats did no work, and bankers, unfortunately, do work. But you would have aristocrats who were incredibly wealthy and everyone else. It's more like that, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, the middle class is being squeezed, I think, from both sides. The real problem is, if you want to have a developed, advanced economy, you need to have a strong middle class, and everything else is secondary. But in America, it feels now to us that, and this is what I've been writing about in my own work for the last book, the feeling is that the country's in retreat. And while middle classes are growing in China and India and Latin America, they're slowly dying out in America as the country goes from a manufacturing economy to an economy where skills can fly all over the world. I always joke that my next book, I don't want to write it, I'm too lazy, so I'll have somebody in India write my next novel, because and it'll probably be better,
Well, I mean, that is kind of the problem. Now, if Ingo were here, what he would remind us would be that he lived in East Germany until he was 27, and he was happy to see the wall go down. But he felt that there was a sort of enforced unity in Germany. Nothing of the old system survived, and everything of the other system survived. In other words, the West Germany took nothing of East Germany with it. Is there anything of the Soviet Union that should have survived?
Well, the Soviet Union, it's important to remember what the Soviet Union, the main republic in the Soviet Union, is Russia. And Russia, if you look at it from a certain angle, has always been a disaster. You know, it was the worst feudalism, then it was the worst socialism, now it's the worst capitalism, you know. So whenever I go back to Russia, I'm reminded that nothing really changes. I went to a restaurant in St. Petersburg where I'm from called 1913, and I said, why is it called 1913? And the owner said, well, that was the only good year in Russian history. You know, so when I look back at the failures of Soviet communism, it's important to remember also that very few systems have worked in that country. In fact, no system has really worked adequately in that country. So, you know,
Inger says, by the way, that systems worked all too well in Germany.
Well, yeah, things work very well in Germany until they don't.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So, but to kind of expand on the question a bit, was there anything you think, I'm not inviting you to say yes to this, I'm just wondering what you think about it, in the ethos of the Soviet Union that was worth having?
Well, you know, there was a small aristocracy, the top party members, but other than that, the rest of the people were fairly equal in terms of financial stuff, anyway. We would all have, you know, I remember as a child having a wonderful kindergarten to go to, having vacations in Yalta and things like that. And they weren't luxurious, you know, it wasn't the Sofitel in Cartagena, but it was, there was something, you felt like you were really a part of something, a sense of unity, as you were saying, that doesn't exist in a country that's very stratified. So that wasn't bad, and the education wasn't bad either. My parents brought to America all the math and science textbooks from Russia because they thought that the textbooks in America were so stupid. You know, as you were in fifth grade and you were still learning how to multiply, you know, whereas in Russia you were already doing calculus and whatever.
So, and designing rockets.
Designing, yes, rockets to bomb Americans with.
Yeah. Right, that may or may not have worked. So that actually, that's quite a telling story that your father thought that, because it kind of reflects on some of the things that you've been saying more recently. As I say, I'm not going into detail about the new book, but there's a certain kind of pessimism that you have been evoking about the future. I mean, you've been talking about how people don't read books anymore, about how technology changes things for people. You could almost suggest that in this phase of capitalism, with its incredible innovation, its fantastic capacity to create new things and new ways of communicating, lie all kinds of possibilities and all kinds of dangers. And this now seems to be preoccupying you, and you seem to have taken the pessimistic angle on that.
Pessimism is my middle name. I've always been pessimistic. Gary Pessimist Steingart. You know, when my parents were, when we were growing up, I remember nothing mattered more than literature, because so much of it was not allowed in Russia. I remember my parents would have mimeographed pages, samizdat pages of Nabokov's Lolita, you know, and they would, you know, read it very carefully and then dispose of it, and then it was, nothing mattered more than literature. Now in Russia, of course, under capitalism, writing is not nearly as important. I was asked to go to St. Petersburg to talk to the students from one of their main universities, literature students, and I thought, oh, this is going to be an interesting discussion, but the first question they had for me was, do you think the movie Avatar is going to be made into a novel? So I thought, okay, it's over, it's all over.
Can I just ask you, is that actually true?
That is absolutely
true. That question was actually asked.
Yeah, a very beautiful young woman, and she said, I have a question. Avatar, a novel soon?
And it's like...
I said, yes, I'm writing it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now that would be a good gig if you could get it. It would keep you. It would keep you in apartments for the rest of your life. It's interesting that you should speak that way. When, in my background, one of the things that my father, who had been brought up in complete poverty in the East End of London, and that was why he had become a communist. But one of the things that he always wanted to do, he was self-taught, completely self-taught. He'd left school at 14, taught himself. He read all the great books of literature. To him, communism essentially was everyone reading Dickens and going to the ballet. That's what he thought it would be like. And, you know, as for all these other things like Avatar, they simply wouldn't be allowed. Wouldn't be permitted. He never quite said that, but that was the kind of implication. And it's quite interesting to find you sort of, in a way, harking back to the same things my father would have, at that stage, have wanted. He actually wrote a pamphlet in 1950, called something like The Menace, The American Menace in Culture, in which he talked about how many terrible American things there were, like comic books and jazz. Yeah, and jazz, yeah, of course.
Jazz, yes. Well, it's interesting because when my parents, when we came to America, my parents worshipped the capitalist system and Ronald Reagan, but they wouldn't allow American culture in the house because it was considered by them to be lower than Russian culture. So in the house, we did not have a television set. We didn't have anything. No English was spoken in the house. You know, it was only Russian literature. By age 9, I was supposed to finish Chekhov. By age 10, Tolstoy. By 11, Dostoevsky, you know. So in the house, it was like going back to Russia. So this very interesting kind of, on the one hand, loving America, loving the system, but on the other hand, worrying that the culture is very corrupt. And I think that that exists not just for post-communist immigrants, but for immigrants from a lot of countries, you know, China, India. They want their children to succeed in the capitalist system, but at the same time, they don't want their children exposed to too much pop culture.
But that takes us back to another aspect of communism in practice, which is its paternalism, which is the notion that what you feel to be good and, if you like, canonical in literature and so on, must be the thing which people in their right minds would appreciate, that people in their right minds would prefer Chekhov to Avatar. But isn't one of the kind of great lessons of diversity is that there are many, very many, very good people who will never like Chekhov and will always like Avatar?
Well, it's a question of the marketplace. The marketplace does not forgive boredom. People can't be bored for even a minute. And the way we live now, in a very digital age, we need to constantly find new things to look at on our iPhones or our computers, and it's very hard to concentrate on something like an entire book. And so, in a huge marketplace of ideas like America, the literature begins to suffer, whereas in the Soviet Union, there was nothing to do. People were so bored. I mean, you know, you could just go to the opera day in and day out, and that was your sole entertainment. even when I was a small kid, I remember going to the Kirov, now the Mariinsky Theater, with my father day in and day out because there was nothing else to do. I mean, it was wonderful opera, but...
But there's that is hilarious, isn't it? Because, of course, in New York, the opera and the ballet are the most expensive things you can possibly do. I mean, we have a place in Britain called Glyndebourne, which is an opera place with an outdoor area and so on, and it costs an enormous amount to get on the waiting list. And I think the same will be true for Friends of the Met, of the New York Met. There's a wonderful irony in the idea that the only thing that you could afford in Leningrad was to go to the opera, and the only thing you probably can't afford to do in New York is to go to the opera.
Yeah, I was back in Russia a month ago, and I went to the Mariinsky Theater, and it was $200 for a ticket. And I remember when it was 2 rubles, you know, and it was such
a shock. Palace of Congress.
So it's, things change so rapidly. And I think one of the scary things, we're talking about communism, capitalism, but I think the future holds something we don't even know yet. And I don't know what it is, but it's going to be a pretty interesting and scary phenomena.
Yeah, it's very difficult when your interviewee says you don't know what it is yet, because it means you can't ask them what they think it's going to be. Gary, what do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. Well, I know what one thing it's going to be. It's going to be a lot warmer. So, you know, I think pretty
maybe
much...
Maybe not in Cartagena.
Yeah, New York will be like Cartagena pretty soon, I think. It's something I've been noticing a lot. I go upstate to the countryside, and even the countryside, I have a very furry dog, a dachshund, you know, the little wiener dog.
And Ingo points out this is a German dog.
It's a German dog, yes. And my German dog is dying from the heat because it's something that he's never experienced before. Every year it goes up, you know, by 1 Celsius in the New York area. And the sea is rising so fast. I live near the sea, near the you know, the East River in New York, and it's just creeping up there. And this is what frightens me the most. Is this is something we have no control over. I mean, we do, but we're not going to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's lapping around the edge of the fifth floor of the Chrysler Building at the moment, somewhere like that. But when you were talking earlier about attention span and many devices, I wondered whether you weren't being too pessimistic in this sense. In Britain, we've never sold more books than we do now, either electronically or as actual books. Never. Partially because it's so much cheaper now to buy a book than it was, let's say, in the 50s and 60s. It would take a greater proportion of your income then. Not only festivals like this at Cartagena, but the parent festival in Britain, Hay Festival, has thousands of people turn up to it. Festivals all over Britain where people want to listen to arguments and discuss books and so on. And I can't help wondering whether sometimes we feel that because something is new, you know, our new things were televisions and then CDs or something like this, and our parents said, that's not going to be any good. You're going to lose all your attention. And we say the same about the coming generations. Maybe they're very able both to read a book and to look at an iPad and use the iPhone and whatever the next generation will be.
Well, I'm not even as worried about the next generation. I'm worried about me, you know. Because since I bought an iPhone, an iPad, an iToothbrush, an iHat, an iShoe, you know, I've become so addicted to this technology that I find it difficult to concentrate. And I think it's because it's very easy to fall in love with the idea that anything you want is at your fingertips. It's very easy to do. But on the other hand, I think there's something to be said for difficulty. It's hard to read a book. I mean, it's hard to get through 300, 400 pages of a book in these days. But when you enter a book, you're doing something special. You're entering the mind of another human being. In America, less people read books than ever. It's obviously different in the UK. Fewer people read books than ever, but more people write than ever. We're a nation not of readers, but of writers. Because I think the American ethos is self-expression at all costs. Nothing is more important than being yourself and constantly telling who you are to other people.
Facebook is one
way to do it, exactly. And in Facebook and in all these other things, you're the hero. You're the hero of the video game or the Facebook or whatever it is. But reading requires a different kind of mindset. It requires one to surrender oneself and to enter the consciousness of another human being. And that's something that's a lot more difficult, I think, for people who are constantly their own heroes. Whenever I take out my iPhone and I put in something onto my Facebook and and somebody says, oh, that's funny, it's an easy way for me to win a kind of admiration, and I think it's easy for everyone to do so. And that's very different from writing a book, I think.
Couldn't we be accused of self-serving here? As people who are writers ourselves, who want other people to read us, and therefore maybe we want them less to publish themselves than to read what we publish in a strange way. I mean, but also the other point I think in what you're saying is what Ingo has called modification. that everything, every emotion, every nuance, everything that everybody has to say to anybody, every private moment becomes something that can be exchanged in some way for money.
Yes. No, whenever we go on Facebook and we put in something about ourselves, you know, who's winning? Facebook is winning. They're making lots of money from everything we do, from everything all of us do if we go on that site. There's a commodification of everything, including one's emotions. You know, you're excited about something, you put it on Facebook, a corporation makes money. It's, you know, that's the free market. That's capitalism in a nutshell. We're all serving someone.
And being served by them.
And being served by them. It's an endless loop.
Where does that leave us? I mean, does that mean... I mean, communism famously started as an idea of the perfectibility of the human being. I mean, it started actually before Karl Marx, but to take Karl Marx's notion that you could reach towards a society that transcended class, that transcended division, which allowed all needs to be met almost effortlessly, it sometimes seems, that Marx's prescription for what the future would actually be like were fairly vague and so on. And then this was taken up by other people as the transition that you would have to go through socialism of the Leninist variety, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and so on. These were the ways to get. But nevertheless, the people who did it, my father, believed firmly that he was trying to build a better world in which people would be better. Likewise, many of the people who believe most in free market capitalism believe that if it spreads, it will be the construction of the better world for everybody through the simple act of being able to choose and to have freedom. Now, from the critiques that you've mounted and straddling both systems, is it your view that believing in either of these two systems was the wrong thing, or actually that this perfectible state is impossible?
Well, the perfectible state is impossible. Life is going to be hard on this planet no matter what happens, no matter what systems we choose. Some systems are better than others. You know, Swedish democracy is better than Egyptian non-democracy, let's say. There's definitely a hierarchy of societies that work better and ones that are worse, but you know, I remember in 2008, just 2-3 years ago, dancing. I never dance. This is a big problem in being in Cartagena in Colombia. I'm not a good dancer. But I remember actually dancing in the streets, you know, when Obama won, and we thought, oh, my God, now it's all going to change. It's all going to be better now, you know, because he won. And, you know, a couple of years later, things haven't happened the way we quite expected them to happen. So, you know, I was a little child hugging Lenin's monument. Then I had a big picture of Ronald Reagan in my bedroom. The only thing I've learned as an adult is to not worship anyone and to simply not put your faith into any one person.
So where
or system.
So where would you put your faith? If we have a lot of young people here this evening, how would you make the struggle for a better life? Where would you put your effort and time?
I mean, this sounds terribly individualistic, but I would just work on oneself, work on making sure one is as educated as can be. It sounds a little trite, but I think the best thing we can do is just to constantly educate ourselves better, more and more, you know, whether it's through the iPhone or through reading Chekhov or Ronald Reagan's memoirs. No, I'm kidding about that. But there are many ways to do it. And I think, you know, one thing I will never lose is the ability to constantly be surprised by what happens. I grew up in one failed empire, the Soviet Union. Now I'm living in another empire with many problems. And probably I'll die in a third empire with an equal amount of problems.
It's quite interesting. If an American would say... You were brought up in one empire, but lots of people wanted to get out of that. You went to another empire, but that was one that people still want to get into.
Yes, people still want to get in there. I mean, I think America's greatest strength, really, the greatest strength we have is the fact that unlike countries like even China China and other Asian countries that are very monolithic in terms of the kind of people who live there, America is still as welcoming as possible. It's a country of immigrants. And if America ever stops becoming a country of immigrants, then you can just close the whole country down. There's no point to it. So the importance of America really is the fact that people like myself were welcomed at age 7, and hopefully that will continue.
Yeah. Okay. Let's open this up to some discussion and contributions from the floor. As I said, because Gary's talking about his new book tomorrow, it would be only courteous to the person chairing that session tomorrow if we were to keep questions about that till then. But any other questions or observations that people have? I'm particularly interested in members of the Colombian Communist Party, if they have come to this session. I think roughly half are members of the Colombian Communist Party, so you are welcome to join in. There's somebody there, I see.
A communist, I think, yeah.
Yes, it's a comrade, definitely a comrade.
I see a red shirt. No.
Yeah, we need the translation.
¿Ya? ¿Me escuchan?
You carry on and I'll try and sort this out.
¿Ya?
Please.
Wait, or... Okay, teniendo en cuenta que el tema de la conversación es comunismo y capitalismo, y si nos hemos dado cuenta que esos dos sistemas han fallado, y ya como el autor lo propuso, que sabe que va a pasar algo, pero que no sabe qué es en realidad, ¿qué viene después del capitalismo? Para usted.
Yeah, this is a question to Ingo, yeah?
Teniendo en cuenta también que el sistema fracasó, más no sé si conocen la parte colombiana, capitalismo acá ha contribuido a desmejorar la calidad de vida de los asalariados. Entonces, ¿cómo? ¿Qué se hace? O sea, no hay que hacer individual, hay que trabajar en junto, pero ¿cómo? Si cada vez vemos que hay más potencia llegando a pisarnos, por decirlo de cierta manera.
Yeah. Well, I think that the future will be the future is shifting to a couple of places. One of them are countries like India and China, to some extent Brazil and Latin America. And the question is, to what extent can that hybrid, for example, in China, of state-run communism and at the same time active capitalism, to what extent can that survive in the future without people getting very upset and demanding more rights? I think it will be very difficult to move from the way capitalism is entrenched in developing world countries now. It's very difficult to go beyond that because people are so used to the idea that, you know, in essence, you can... People think they can sort of take the American model and make something better of it in their own countries. And they ignore the fact that the American model is in deep trouble in its own country. So what that third way will be is still hard to say. But I think communism will never make the kind of comeback that some people may want it to make.
What some people may be inclined to point to is to Brazil. In England, there's been a lot of discussion about Brazil. Essentially, what you have is a moderate leftist who's operating under the circumstances of capitalism, but with an eye to social justice. We don't know yet whether some of it has been luck, but certainly we're talking in England about the Brazilian miracle. That's how people speak about it. And contrasting that experience with, let's say, what seems to be the beginning of a disaster in Venezuela, the gradual notion that... But I have to claim and say here that I'm not an expert either on Brazil or Venezuela. So if there are any very ardent Chavistas here tonight, I apologize to you. I'm sure actually that everything in Venezuela is quite wonderful. Yes, I'm going to take somebody down here first, actually, because they were the... Oh, you really want this person? Okay, right. This is interesting. You do what you're told here as chair.
Thank you. I recently read a paper by the United Nations saying that livestock is the main cause of global warming right now in the world. And this was an information that I didn't have before. I didn't know anything about it. So my question is, I was really surprised because I feel that I am a very informed person because of what you were saying right now, that there's so much information everywhere and you have access to lots of magazines and newspapers and all kinds of stuff. And this was a paper published like 4 years ago, and it was saying officially that livestock and the consumption of animal products is the main cause by far of global warming.
You mean it's the cow's fault?
Yeah, it's, well, okay.
Yeah, no,
kind
it's,
of.
I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I have killed all my livestock.
Not your dachshund.
I don't have any sheep or cows. But no, it's true. It's true that there are huge, the emissions from the cow and the sheep cause a lot of the global warming to happen. So if we eat less meat, theoretically, there will be less global warming. But we should also use less coal, I think, as well. And in New York, where I live, it's wonderful because nobody knows how to drive. So we don't have any cars, except for the taxis. And I feel like a good global citizen in not driving and not causing any harm to the planet. But I do eat a lot of meat. And that's a big problem for my health as well.
There is a very big argument and a difficult one for us meat eaters. There's a very big argument for becoming vegetarians. I know, hard in a country like Colombia, but there is a very big argument that says we should do it. You first. Yeah. Can I have this person now? It's okay.
Thanks.
And then him.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm loud. Brave New World, I'm a teacher, is a very scary picture of that happy world. It is a happy communist capitalism or a happy capitalist communism, I don't know. I think it is the most honest portrayal of our world. I would really appreciate your input. Are we already living in this Brave New World?
Are we already living in this brave new world? Yes, I think we're living, I think the shift, people don't quite understand this, but I think the shift from a pre-digital to a post-digital society happened so quickly that, I mean, it's hard to remember what life was like in 1994.
Yeah.
I can't remember what my life was like. Do you remember? I didn't spend all the time sitting in front of a computer. I had friends. I went to parties, I drank, you know. It was a much more interesting life in some ways. I really miss it. So I think the Brave New World is here, and maybe the next generation will figure out how to live in it better. Because I feel like sort of the last dinosaur as the ice age is beginning, and I'm about to be, you know, it's very warm, and I'm still a big reptile, and I'm not going to live very long. That's how I feel in this new world. So maybe it's a dystopia to me, but to the next generation, it will be something much better.
And we have people from the next generation to ask these questions.
Good night. I got a doubt between communism and capitalism. We got these countries, you know, Finland, Sweden, Switzerland, that seems to merge these two ideals. And they actually work. And, well, that says Newsweek because they're the most developed countries. But I must say, is there any flaws in that kind of system or new government?
If you read Stieg Larsson, you will see there are a lot of faults in the Swedish system. You know, whenever I go to Russia, to St. Petersburg, I have to fly through Helsinki, the capital of Finland, and I'm always shocked. It's only 40 minutes away by airplane, but it's like a whole different world. You know, you land at the airport, there's some kind of robot that comes and takes your luggage. And
that's a very harsh way of describing a Finnish person.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's true, though, yeah. A very tall robot comes and takes her.
Tall and blonde robot.
Tall blonde robot, yeah. But I think with countries like Finland and Sweden, they're very homogenous countries. There's very few differences. And it's always been a small country with one ethnicity. The key is, how do you have a country that's very diverse and maintain a system like that? I don't think such a country exists, to my knowledge. It's always very small, homogenous countries like Finland, Sweden, Norway.
But the question is a good one. I mean, there are many essentially, these are all capitalist countries, but they have different ways of operating their democracy and of trying to maintain a degree of fairness in society. And I think Gary was really onto an important word with the word fairness. I think Americans have been taught a difficult lesson about fairness and unfairness, which is a difficult concept anyway. And it's how really you try to rebuild a notion of fairness into a society is a big discussion in England. And I bet it's a very, very big discussion here in Colombia as well. Ultimately, if you don't have fairness, you have a whole lot of people who end up not having much of a stake in the system, and that's difficult. It's a fairly obvious point. There's somebody right at the back. First somebody right at the front, and then somebody right at the back.
Mr. Anovich, I am a very fan of conspiracies, and I wanted to ask you, we all hear conspiracies about capitalism in the United States, but we never hear conspiracies in a communist, like Soviet Russia. We never hear, like, the power is controlled by, I don't know. Why do you think that happens?
Because in Russia, if you had a conspiracy theory, you'd be put in prison. maybe one reason. It's true. We could apply it to China, couldn't we? We could say that we have lots of conspiracy theories about how the Americans do this and the Israelis and so on. But we'd have no conspiracy theories about the Chinese. Which is funny, really, because they're much more secretive in China and very powerful than anybody else. I have never thought about this question before, and I need to think about it. Yes, and somebody right at the back now.
I'm interested to know if you think that happiness can be usefully calibrated or quantified, and how.
Yeah, there's always a survey of happiness that goes on, and the happiest nations are always Denmark, and I think Brazil is pretty happy.
And Colombia.
And Colombia is happy too, really? You're happy?
Yeah, we
have. Oh my God. I have to move here.
But you're not happy now, though, are you?
Colombia's happy, okay. Yeah. I'm happy for you.
It's true. It's actually true. I mean, I can't remember whether I was reading it in a survey conducted by the Colombian Tourist Board, but no, Colombia is one of the five happiest countries as regards people reporting themselves as being happy. However, people reporting themselves as being happy may be a very unreliable guide, because one person's happiness is another person's misery.
Well, I agree, and I also think that, you know, stress plays a very big role in one's ability to be happy. As the economy in America continues to become more cruel to a lot of people, as it continues to decline, there's a lot of stress. People are trying to grab what little is left, and that creates for a lot of stress, and that creates for a lack of happiness, whereas in a society where there's more equal distribution of wealth, there is more happiness, I would say.
Yeah. Incidentally, I'll just say that the very, very great political philosopher Amartya Sen has written about this question about happiness. He says happiness should not be the goal of policy. What should be the goal is that human beings can to the maximize their capability. He says the question of capability. In other words, the thing that you want to do with your life, that you yourself wish to do with your life, is more important than a notion of happiness. And I have to say that appeals to me too. The last thing I want to do is for everybody to want me to be happy. That makes me very unhappy. You too.
I'm angry too.
Yeah. We're very unhappy about that together. Yes,
señores panelistas, auditorio en general, muy buenas noches, cordial saludo. Les saluda Marlon Mendoza, sociólogo de La Guajira. ¿Tendrá el movimiento socioideológico del siglo XXI la sustentabilidad plena de felicidad para aquellas naciones latinoamericanas que lo han adaptado a su sistema de gobierno?
Could you translate?
Repite, por favor. ¿Puedes repetir la pregunta?
No, que tendrá el movimiento socioideológico conocido como socialismo del siglo XXI la sustentabilidad de felicidad para los pobladores de las naciones que lo han ajustado a su sistema de gobierno.
Let you handle this one.
The translation that's come over to us is quite abstract.
I'll translate for you. He's asking if Chavez socialism you see as the solution of the problems in these countries here in Latin America.
Right.
I would say I am not enough of an expert on Latin America to give you a solution. It's interesting. I mean, when we see Chavez, my parents watch a very Republican station in America, a television station called Fox News. And you're familiar with it, yeah. And I find it very frightening, but my parents love it. You know, they watch it all day long. And I think used to be Osama bin Laden, I think, was the main villain of that station, but now Hugo Chavez is on all the time. It's very difficult for me to make an assessment of him because I've never been to Venezuela, but perhaps you can...
No, I've never been to Venezuela either, but it seems to me that we have seen people like Hugo Chavez at various times in the world before. We've encountered such people before. Every time people hope that it will be different, and every time it isn't different. That's my observation about it. You have an expression both in English and American: if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
Bueno, después de, finalmente, en su última reflexión, usted recomendaba un poco volver hacia uno mismo, como en una posición más individualista, como la formación, el conocimiento. Yo considero que poco a poco hemos llegado ya hacia un individualismo y hemos perdido otros conceptos como la solidaridad, la comunidad y hacia adelante, pues cualquiera que haya colocado el título de esta conferencia, creo que lo que llega a una sociedad, lo que está llegando poco a poco a la sociedad con estos sistemas de tecnología es un individualismo en donde de pronto terminamos desconociendo al que vive enseguida cada vez más. En las sociedades latinoamericanas uno encuentra que ese acceso al conocimiento es cada vez más limitado y que evidentemente la escasez de estos espacios en las sociedades como las nuestras solamente está dirigido a ciertos grupos muy pequeños que tienen acceso al conocimiento. ¿Qué nos esperaría entonces hacia el futuro en una sociedad cada vez más individualista?
Well, I think you make a fine point. I think, however, that it has to work both ways. We have to focus on individual achievement. America now is doing very badly in education. We're the 31st country in math, 17th in reading. So even as individuals, the country is not producing a good access to education. And that's partly because there is a system where there's education for the elite, and then there's education for everybody else. And that's a huge problem, and I'm sure that's a huge problem in developing countries as well. But I think if you create education across the board so that everyone has access to it, you get a better individual, but you also get a better society. I think, you know, the society is composed of people. And this is something that I realized, you know, when I was growing up in Russia, we were all very well educated. Everyone had a great education. But at the same time, when we came together, the society didn't work. And I think it's maybe because even though we had a good education, so much of it was just forced upon us. We were told, you have to learn this, you have to learn this. And there was no sense of creativity, no sense of exploration on your own part. So both things are needed. You need both a focus on the individual and a focus on teaching young people how to care for the people around them. And if you have both things, I think you can really accomplish something.
I would like to add to this that there is a kind of idea that if you could somehow go back, you would go in time, you would find the old, more authentic communities that existed, a neighborliness that existed in a time before the world became small. The problem is that the world is never going to be as it was. So I would say that the question is how you find new forms of community rather than continuously harking back to the old forms which have gone forever. I mean, one of the things that Gary said, and I think it was right about America, I think it's right about the world. We now live, whether we like it or not, in a world where people will move to the place they think they will be happy. They won't stay just because you tell them to stay, unless you make it really difficult. In Europe, we have people coming to Europe who undergo the most terrible journeys in order to get to Europe to live there. There's no way of stopping them. Everything that could be done to stop them has been done, and it doesn't work. And as they come in, they change the notion of the communities that are already there. And I would say that we have to begin to work with that. So we have to begin to think again about what communities consist of, about what's important about them. That would be my view. That's very... I know. Yes. We have time for two more questions.
Buenas noches. Tenemos una conversación donde hablamos de socialismo y capitalismo. Socialismo y capitalismo. La cuestión es que los sistemas sociales tienen un nacimiento, un desarrollo y un fin. Sí, podemos verlo como el feudalismo, el socialismo en algún momento y ahora el capitalismo, ¿no? Lo que quisiera es si podemos considerar que el capitalismo en este momento, si bien se está desarrollando en Asia de otras formas, produciendo muchos artículos, cosas de estas para el bienestar, entendido de esa forma. Si tenemos en cuenta cosas como que el mundo está cada vez más urbanizado, que cada vez hay menos agua potable, que cada vez es más costoso obtener las materias primas para producir estos artículos, que cada vez sabemos más personas en el mundo demandando salud, educación, cosas de esas. Más que de ponernos a hablar si el capitalismo o el socialismo o lo que sea, ¿por qué no considerar como este tipo de cosas que están presentes y son reales? No sé, es como eso, o sea, ¿para dónde vamos si cada vez tenemos menos materias primas, menos espacio?
Yeah. Yes. Gary.
The future what are we going to do when we run out of oil? What are we going to do? I'm sorry. What do we do when we run out of oil? What do we do when we run out of water? What do we do during all these different things? This is what requires effort among all the nations of the world to come together and do something. Otherwise, no nation can act on its own. And I don't see people coming together because each nation has its own needs. What are America's needs? America's needs are to slow down its decline and maybe reverse its decline. China's needs, India's needs are to build entire new middle classes very quickly. These needs do not work in concert with the future of the world as a whole, the environment, basic civil rights. Everything is in danger from the fact that we need things very quickly. So I don't see a very good solution, but perhaps my friend here does.
Actually, the only solution I see is the one offered to me by the organizers, which is to end immediately. All I can say is, for those people who left early, this shows the difference between capitalism and communism. If you'd left a speech by Leonid Brezhnev earlier, you would have been arrested. But here, you're free to leave. Can I thank Gary Steingart very much
thank
for
you.
Having been such a wonderful person to speak this evening. And thank you, too.
Thank you.